David Sarita's first aspiration in life, as I mentioned, was to become an astronaut. In 1968, he and a friend witnessed a UFO along with hundreds of other witnesses. After this experience, David grew up as a UFO enthusiast, never living in doubt of the phenomena that has swept the world since the Roswell incident in 1947. His interest in space, religion, philosophy, astronomy, and science led him on his career in related fields, and he has studied world religion, science, physics, paranormal psychology for more than 25 years. He's our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Hello, David. How are you?
Good, actually. Good to meet you, George, in person at the Bay Area UFO Expo on September 9th and 10th.
Yeah, that was fun. I had a good time out there. How about you?
Good. Yeah, it was great. You know, I like sitting down and meeting all the people and having them come up to my table and tell me their UFO stories.
Do you go to many conferences, David?
I've lectured everywhere from Dallas to Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco. Not a lot anymore. I prefer to do this, to speak on the radio, but it's always nice to meet people face to face. And, you know, the turnouts are, you know, that was a decent turnout at that conference. I mean, sometimes I spoke in Roswell once and you only get, maybe a couple hundred people out there. And you think that thousands would flock out to the desert.
Are you still trying to get on a space shuttle?
Well, that's one of the things I did at the conference. I announced something kind of radical, and I'm not even expecting this to work, but I'm announcing a petition to petition my way to Congress on the space shuttle to look for UFOs, because so many Americans believe that NASA is not forthcoming in telling us the truth about what they're seeing on these missions, and what we'll talk about in a minute is STS-115. And my take on that. And in fact, I actually, when I was doing my film Evidence the Case for NASA UFOs, throughout doing my research throughout the 1990s, one of my dialogues was with a NASA scientist named Dr. Joseph Newth III, who was head of the astrochemistry branch at the Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. And one of the things he told me was that if you get enough signatures from the American public, you might be able to petition your way onto the shuttle to end this debate. Are there really UFOs, or is everything just dust and debris and space junk? So I decided to, take him up on that.
Well, what's going to happen?
Well, I don't think I'm a skydiver. I really don't have my fear of going into space, but I think realistically, one day I would like to have a sponsor. I mean, that would be my biggest dream, would be have somebody sponsor me and put me on a Russian rocket onto the space station, but that would cost an awful lot of money. I want to make a point with this. I mean, with my signatures, when I bring them to NASA, I'm actually going to videotape my arriving there, showing them how many people really believe you guys are not telling us the truth, and I'll demonstrate why. For example, when I was talking to Joseph Newth III during our debates about whether we were seeing debris or space junk, firstly, I researched what space junk really is, and it's mostly defined as pieces of small, like at the most 10 centimeters in size, pieces of tin foil. They never throw solar panels and doors and, big trash bins out into space.
Right.
In fact, I found when I researched the shuttle, they rarely ever dump water. They recycle it, and only in a case of emergency they would dump it, because water is very heavy and very expensive to bring out into space. So in the current story, in fact, one of the debates I got in with Joseph Newth III was that he said this, if there are five cameras mounted in the bay and you can take any two of them that are seeing the same object and you can triangulate the distance between the two cameras and match them up into, using trigonometry, you can determine the distance between the camera and the object. And when STS-115 was being reported around the, the 19th and 20th of this month, one of the things the NASA spokesman said is that we don't know how far away the objects are, and therefore we don't know how big they are.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that was just pure bull. I mean, NASA was just pulling the wool over people's eyes, and any good mathematician knows that that's not true. In fact, if you can triangulate the distance between two, using two cameras, you do know how big the objects are, and you consider that the space shuttle orbits the Earth 300 miles above the Earth. The top of the atmosphere is 100 miles, and most junk, which is tin foil and very tiny pieces of debris, would fall and decay into much lower orbits. You would never see anything that far away. from the shuttle. If the shuttle's at 300 miles and your space junk is even 50 miles away, you're not going to see it.
No, you, even a handful of tinfoil, you wouldn't see it.
And then you have to wonder, the other thing is, why, when space junk is routine, it's something astronauts are trained to see, why this mission did they suddenly make a big deal out of space junk? Like, all of a sudden, in fact, one of the reports was, and Fox News National was reporting this very distinctly differently than CNN and NBC and ABC. On Fox National, one of the astronauts said, quote, that this is very serious. There is an object outside, and it's passing us. And he was very alarmed and very serious. I don't believe an astronaut would be that alarmed over a piece of space junk. In fact, for the object to be passing them, the shuttle is going prograde orbits around the Earth with the motion of gravity at 18,000 miles an hour, making 90-minute orbits. So if you're passing the shuttle, you have to have internal energy or you're a meteorite. And meteorites are doing 35, 45,000 miles an hour, and they go streaking by, and you can barely – in fact, you don't even see them because they – you don't see them until they strike the top of the atmosphere. They're a kind of void in the area where the shuttle is. The shuttle is 200 miles above the top of the atmosphere. So you really got to wonder what these guys were seeing. And then going into – my source, Donald Ratch, he actually goes to the NASA library and he sends me, has been sending me videotapes from starting from STS-114, which was the first mission after the big accident, 2 summers ago. And during that mission, an amazing object showed up that I've been studying and zooming in on. It's actually in my Dan Aykroyd movie. It looks to me like a golden mean rectangle. It has the perfect dimensions, 1 to 1.618. dimensions of a golden mean rectangle, and I immediately thought of the, you know, Arthur C. Clarke's movie, you know, 2001 and 2010, and the golden rectangles that were appearing, you know, the mysterious objects that signify a higher intelligence in the universe. And this thing is luminous. It's a golden mean rectangle. It has a pulse. It's very bright, and from a distance, it would be cylindrical. Well,
right.
During STS-115, the reports were that the object was cylindrical. Those were some of the early reports coming in. I was listening as I was traveling from the north, and I was getting calls from friends who were watching the news. And another one was more pill-shaped or disc-shaped. And then you think, okay, then STS-121, Jeff Challenger posted on the Internet this disc-shaped, very translucent, low mass, which are the kind of UFOs I look for. Luminous object just suddenly seems to be going by. And one of the things, first things that NASA says is these are pieces of debris that are floating up off the floor in the shuttle, and when they get close to the camera, they produce this optical illusion. Well, one of the things I did with, for example, on STS-75, the famous tether incident, is I took, you know, my 3CCD video camera, which CCD video cameras have phenomenal depth of field of focus. I mean, phenomenal. You can have a penny right in front of the camera, and when the camera's unzoomed and 300 miles in the distance, the Earth below is in focus. So your depth of field of focus is phenomenal. So that means you could see something getting close to the lens, but when you zoom in, even on a dime disappears completely from the focal plane of the camera. Now, in the STS-75, you see these things floating around out there. They're all pulsing. They're all going at different velocities, which debris could never do.
Debris always goes at the same rate.
It all drifts at the same rate, and that gets into Newton and Galileo, you know, Newtonian physics, unless it has internal energy. And so that was the first thing I noticed. And then it survives this long zoom into the shot, and nothing disappears. In fact, the zoom just keeps going on and on and on, and you hear the astronaut say that he's completely zoomed in, and they're still there. Which means they're very far away. They're very distant objects, and that's when we see them going behind the tether. So, again, looking, you know, at STS-115, this most recent story, you know, I think looking at NASA's official definition of space junk, they don't throw the trash out the trash chute. They have a wealth of photography of real space junk, and it's possible. Why were all the astronauts so alarmed, and why did they make a big deal out of space junk if it's something they see on every mission? And then all of a sudden we hear that it's junk, and they come up with some of these photographs, but none of the photographs are identified with actual parts, like in a service manual. This is a trash bag. And the one that someone said was a trash bag, when I looked at it, you know, it's really a beautiful-looking shape, whatever it is.
Is 15STS-115, is that the most remarkable of all of these possibilities?
No, actually it isn't. But what's the most remarkable about it is that the word UFO was used all over the media. And it's I was actually so excited. I was coming out of my skin, you know, telling my fiance, Crystal, oh, my God, they're actually admitting on the news that they're making contact with an unidentified flying object. And, in fact, in NASA's SIM Planet Quest, they have this, you know, search for extraterrestrial planets. At the last slide on their PowerPoint presentation, NASA says they hope to find proof of life in other worlds. And in fact, they anticipated that when they formed NASA in 1958, you know, during the studies that they did on how, you know, the Brookings Report studies and how humans would respond if they did find evidence of extraterrestrial life. And it's really this beautiful image, and you really think, oh, NASA's going to tell us if they made contact. And this is another one of those cases. Now, I can't say I know that they're not looking at space junk. I can just point to all the reasons why I think they're not telling us the truth. They could easily give us some fake footage from another mission, and we don't know what we're seeing of pieces of junk. But I'm just telling you from simple physics. And then you get into something even more complicated. From simple physics, I don't believe, firstly, the astronauts would be alarmed over space junk. There's no way junk can travel faster than the space shuttle and pass it.
And it was moving along, and you're right, and passing.
And it couldn't even keep up to it. It would actually drift behind it. Very slowly, it would drift away, and then it would be so far away. And then when you look at the manual definition of what junk is, they never throw anything away out there that is bigger than a piece of tin foil that's a couple of centimeters across.
Well,
and that's
now,
some of the biggest.
What do you think, David, really? What do you think it was, and how big do you think it might have been?
Well, from being an experienced photographer for 25 years and looking at what happens when objects get further and further away from you, their lack of detail gets greater and greater and greater, depending on the optics and the film or the videotape you're looking at. But from experience, I would say there's no doubt those objects are very far away because there's not a lot of detail. It's very poor detail. There's only one still photo that might have been taken with a very long lens of something that's supposed to be some kind of a trash bag, but it doesn't look anything like a trash bag to me. In fact, it's a very sophisticated-looking shape. And I don't know what, no one has ever identified it in a manual with a part.
Now, how did we, the world, find out about this? And if it indeed was a cover where they had to say, oh my gosh, it's space debris, that means the video was spotted by us before they wanted us to see it. How did that all happen?
Well, see, that's all been happening. People watch NASA television, and there's a lot of guys like Donald Ratch and Martin Stubbs in Canada and Jeff Challenger and literally hundreds of others who...
And Hoagland, all these people,
all of
right?
them are archiving NASA TV live, and then, you know, you start to see these luminous pulsing objects, which I've watched on, you know, YouTube of 115, and people start asking questions, what is that? But never before in the history of spaceflight has NASA been so alarmed over space junk. And, you know, when Richard Hoagland came on, I was driving, you know, the first night. I mean, he was suspicious right away.
Yes.
And I thought was being quite conservative. And I don't know if he saw the Fox National report versus CNN. It was very different. The astronauts were clearly alarmed. And I just can't accept that you guys aren't trained to know what space junk is, because every other mission preceding this one, the astronauts know what it is. And they never make a big deal. Oh, my God, we're being followed by a trash bag, and the whole world needs to know about it. Why did we all need to hear the word UFO and then find out it was space junk?
And how did that happen? Tell me about that.
And
the
is
word
that
UFO.
A cover for NASA to say that all of the preceding footage of anomalous objects are just space junk and the case is resolved? There was even some talk on Fox National that in the end they still don't know what the objects were, and there were some reports that the astronauts had seen things like this and they've never known what they are. And that means you have unidentified. How did it happen?
Yeah, who coined the phrase on this mission that it was a UFO that they saw?
Well, the word UFO just started to appear in headlines all over the place. And
you think media people developed it?
No, I think it was an astronaut who used that term. I think that was the first report I heard on Fox National. But the name of the astronaut and the quote, I mean, Katie Coleman, astronaut Catherine Coleman, you know, this is in the beginning of my Aykroyd movie. She's quoted as saying we have an unidentified flying object. And then when congressional investigations were done into this, she said, oh, she was just kidding. But you never hear any laughter. All you hear is dead silence after she says that. And then I know from studying the space shuttle that there are two channels on the space shuttle. One is an encrypted Department of Defense radio broadcast, and the other is the public channel. When she makes a statement like that and there's no laughter, I can't believe she's just kidding around. In fact, you know, why was there so much silence after she said that? And I think that's because they switched to the other channel. So that was – she's actually used the word UFO before. But
of course, though, UFO also could mean, you know, an object that is unidentified. Doesn't have to
sure.
be a flying craft.
Sure, but they know what space junk is. And as I'm defining it by their manual, 10 centimeters in length pieces of tinfoil, you will not see those from 50 miles away or 100 miles away, let alone – the top of the atmosphere at 200 miles away from the shuttle. I mean, you can't see anything from that far away unless it's massive. So the further this alleged space junk gets away, and the fact that you can actually see it, it means it's bigger than the manual definition of space junk. They don't throw away solar panels and doors and you know, big pieces of junk. I mean, we have the booster stages of rockets that – but those things drop very quickly back down into the Earth and disintegrate in the atmosphere. So you're not looking at anything like that. So why is it that you're seeing something that is obviously larger than any definition of space junk? I think the astronauts were seeing UFOs, and I think they have been seeing them, and that's why the petition. It's going to be up on my website in a couple of days, the davidserrita.blogspot that you have.
You want to go up there with your equipment, with some cameras?
I want to go up there
you
with
want to find one.
Invisible wavelength cameras, and that's another thing. Dr. Joseph Knuth III told me very clearly, and I've gotten into this debate with James Olberg, very clearly, and in fact I have the notes right in front of me here, on the exact wavelengths that the low-level black and white cameras can see into. And he says that basically... the camera, first he says it can see visible and near ultraviolet photons. We do not see ultraviolet with the naked eye. It's invisible to the naked eye. Ultraviolet is divided into near ultraviolet, far ultraviolet, and extreme ultraviolet. All three of them are wider in bandwidth than the rainbow spectrum that we see from red to violet. But when he actually gives me the different types of sensors on the actual camera itself, he says, quote, I would be amazed if the optics were not cored so that the UV ultraviolet cutoff wavelength would be 180 nanometers, if sapphire cutoff drops to 160 nanometers, and if for CAF2 the cutoff is 135 nanometers. Well, inadvertently, he's actually telling me that if the camera is not only seeing near ultraviolet, it's actually seeing into the far UV, because far UV sees, you know, 200 to 10 nanometers, and we're going below 200 nanometers when we're talking about 135 nanometers. So we're actually seeing into the far UV as well as the near UV, and that's incredible depth into the invisible spectra that human beings don't see. And that's another area of UFO phenomenon that I've talked about before.
Hey, David, when we come back after the break, though, let's also talk about our friend Eric Julien, the former French air traffic controller. He claimed we were going to get zapped a few months ago. Nothing ever happened. I want to get your reaction to that, okay?
All right.
We'll talk about that and some other things with David Serrita. David's website, we've got a couple direct links at coasttocoastam.com. That includes his website and his blog. So go take a look at those. His new book, Evidence, the Case for NASA UFOs. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Lots to talk about with David Serrita. David, let's talk about Eric Julien. He was so convinced that we were going to get zapped by an asteroid or something was going to hit us, and nothing ever did. Give me your take on all that, because, you know, for a moment, it seems like you understood him, then you kind of even backed away from it.
Well, I think I heard his story, but you have to refresh my memory on it.
He was the one who is the former French air traffic controller, and he's the one who thought that several months ago there was a definitive asteroid that was going to hit us. He even had the date picked. He
right,
even had the location.
Remember?
Yeah, he thought it was going to splash into the ocean,
mm-hmm.
and nothing ever happened. But, I mean, this guy believed it so much, he really stuck his neck out.
Yeah, there were stories going all over the Internet about it. You know, most of the predictions in the psychic world, I mean, some are accurate, some are not. I mean, I've dealt with, you know, psychic phenomena, and some I've met some very, very good psychics. But I kind of take it with a grain of salt, because it's not that they don't get accurate information. It's just that, and in this case, I don't even believe it was 100% psychic. I think they were, you know, NASA was actually searching for these things out there. But the game of prediction in quantum physics is brutal. I mean, scientists are happy when they can get close to 1% accuracy in prediction. And then when you get into astrophysical models, you know, planets in the galaxies and shooting stars and meteorites, it's still very difficult, even for some of the best physicists, to predict when they see these things coming in if they're going to actually strike us. So, and then there are our spiritual forces at play. I really believe in the if you get millions of people thinking, you know, to avoid a collision, you can actually do that. So it's hard to tell, you know, what is actually happening in the end, you know, and how that all played out.
If you could change one thing in any ufologist's quest to get information, if you could obtain a piece of data that was just so compelling, what would you want to see, whether it be a government file or information that some witness, David, gave you? What would you like to see?
Well, more than anything, what drives me on this is you know, seeing this UFO in Berkeley in 1968. It's actually Albany, walking home from school, and, you know, clearly looking at a metallic shimmering disc that was silent, defying gravity. I would want to know, was that UFO one of ours, or was it from another planet? But the answer is already coming to me, and even right now I'm filming my new film, From Here to Andromeda, which starts with, you know, me as a pessimist not believing that we're actually going to save, you know, our planet, and we need to find a new planet to live on. And one of the things I did is we went to my elementary school, which I haven't been to in over 35 years.
That's a true. And doesn't it look small when you go back there?
It's incredible. I mean, I remembered everything, how I walked home from school, you know, the honeysuckles along the fence. But this is going to scare you. What I saw was on the pavement, in the asphalt, in the basketball court, I saw this kid who made a drawing of himself. And this kid's a good drawer. He draws his checkered shirt, his face and his eyes.
Yeah.
And right across from him on the asphalt is an extraterrestrial. And I filmed this. And, you know, when people see this, they're going to think, in my new film, I made this up. But I swear on anything, I will give any oath that this is absolutely true. And what are the odds that I would come back to my school, and I haven't even seen it in over 38 years. I'm 45 today. That was in 1967.
Oh, by the way, happy birthday, David.
Thank you. And that another kid is obviously having experiences. And I started to think, well, what if, you know, Berkeley is a portal, and what if they have been contacting children there for, you know, decades? And I was just one of many contactees in that school. And what started to happen to me were dreams about the propulsion systems of the UFO. And then when I started to play hide and go seek and kick the can in San Francisco, I would count to 100 looking at the Pleiades. And then when I saw the Billy Meyer photographs, I said, you know, on television in the 1970s, I went, oh my God, that was the epiphany for that, oh my God, UFOs are a phenomenon. I saw one of those when I was a kid, and I never stopped thinking about it.
That was the clincher for you, wasn't it?
So I would want to know the answer. I mean, and one of the things I did during the filming is I went up to the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, and why are UFOs always being seen and crashing near our nuclear labs, our research labs? Lawrence Berkeley National Lab has a perfect view, and I got some video footage right where I saw the UFO. And then you think of Roswell and, you know, Los Alamos and the Trinity site. I mean, it seems like UFOs, and even the caller you had tonight who talked about the UFOs in Vietnam, you wonder if they're watching us in our wars and in our dramas, and they're really following our progress scientifically in aeronautics and space. So that would be the answer I would want to know. I would want my question answered first, but I'm starting to think that it wasn't one of ours. The dreams would not happen if it was one of ours about the propulsion system. There was some definite telepathy going on. And I do have one traumatic memory in that when we moved from Albany on the Berkeley border to a house in Berkeley. And when my mother remarried David Cooper, my name became David Cooper. I remember having this babysitter, and in the middle of the night, I went into sleep paralysis, and it was so terrifying that I woke up screaming my head off like a maniac, and I still remember it, like feverish, almost feverish temperature of fear in my body. But there's something behind the fear and why I was screaming and what was happening to me in the paralysis that I don't remember. And I think there might have been a contact going on, and it was just too terrifying for me at that age to deal with.
What a thing for a little lad to go through, Dave.
Yeah, I mean, and to throw me off in life. You know, I did always want to be an astronaut from that point on, but I think I could have had, I could have gone down the straight and narrow and been a lawyer or a doctor and not have been bothered by all this. But now my love for propulsion and how to move through the universe has actually led to tonight the release of my new book, Singularity. Actually, the book that I'm releasing now is Singularity, which we've talked about two times on your show, and
yes,
I've made major breakthroughs in, and that's at lulu.com/David Sarita.
I want to devote next hour to, David, to talk about propulsion systems, mm-hmm, and what you think might be used for them to travel and what we might have to do in the future as well. But do you believe that there is a dual space program going on at NASA, one that we see and one that, and I don't mean for the military now, but one that is so black ops, mm-hmm, that we may never see?
Oh, I believe that without question. In fact, some of the stories I heard at the conference were from people who had been near. I've had three people who don't even know each other who all have told me about giant triangles in east of Riverside, California, near Death Valley. And it can't be a coincidence. And all of them have pointed to Lockheed Martin and these giant triangles. In fact, at the conference, I asked John Lear and about UFOs just at dinner. I just introduced myself, and he was, his daughter was a huge fan of the new Aykroyd movie I have out. And he said, all the UFOs, the ones that, the triangles, the Phoenix lights, they're all ours. But the real ETs are here, but they're keeping a low profile. And I thought, damn, I wish I got that on camera because I think I might believe him. I think I believe that there is an alternative space program. And now, this is even more shocking. CNN announced on September 1st, 2006, that if we destroy this planet, this is the headline, will science find us a new one? And when I looked at those headlines, I had already started filming From Here to Andromeda, which is all about that. If we destroy this planet, will science find us a new one? And then you think of what the question you just posed. If we already have an alternative space program, are, authorities on this planet or secret societies choosing who gets to exodus planet Earth and go to the new planet?
If need be.
Is it that NASA says, I mean, they have this very aggressive, it's called SIM, S-I-M, Planet Quest, Searching for New Worlds. NASA is now going ultra-aggressive. Dr. Geoff Marcy of the UC Berkeley is one of the heads of the project, and they've identified more than 160 planets in solar systems since 1995, but not one of them, they claim, can sustain human life.
If I were an elitist, David, if I were an elitist, the first thing I would do, assuming then I had more money than God, mm-hmm, I would want to make sure that I had some kind of massive underground bunker that would give me the lifestyle that I was accustomed to, if I was making that kind of money and if I were an elitist. So I would take care of that problem first, mm-hmm, and let's assume they've done that. I think that's the easy one. Then the second one would be these Illuminati folks, mm-hmm, they would say, now, first of all, we tap into taxpayers' money all the time. We use it whenever we want. What are we going to do if an asteroid hits this planet and wipes out the entire planet and our bunker doesn't even work? What's our next step to survive?
I know, and it's kind of, to me, I kind of like that as a suspense, mechanism that God or the Creator puts into, and the fear of that threat into the human perspective, because we have to figure out the greatest problem in physics, which I tackle in Singularity, which is how do you get from here to another star system, let alone if our galaxy is very young and doesn't have organic life as we are, and how do you get to find another planet? And then you think of, for example, the Buddhist perspective. In fact, this is a question I would love to have posed to the Dalai Lama when he was here. You think about, in Tibetan Buddhism, when we die, every one of us approaches the clear light of enlightenment, which is really heaven from the Christian perspective. But most fear it because they're afraid of that much love, that much joy, that much ecstasy. We actually fear it because we're not evolved enough to live in it. So we reject it. We judge it retrospect to the truth that it is in relationship to where we're really at. And we go, oh, my God, I can't handle that much love. So we go back to school, this school called Earth, but it's not there anymore because we destroyed it. Now, where do 8 billion souls go, and only a percentage of them, according to the Buddhists, can enter heaven because they're not evolved enough? In Buddhism, if you fear the clear light heaven, you have to reincarnate in the organic, you know, human flesh realm to keep learning until you can evolve to the point where you can withstand that intensity of enlightenment to live with it permanently. Now, in the Buddhist perspective, if there's no bodies for you to reincarnate into, and if many of us have been reincarnating as souls on this planet for millennia, and say I have thousands of lifetimes on this planet, where do I go next? I mean, as a soul, well, we think, okay, that's what my movie's about, From Here to Andromeda. I want to find out how to get to Andromeda because NASA can't even find a single planet in our galaxy. So let's try the closest galaxy, but it's 2.2 million light years away. And doing the speed of light, it's going to take you 2.2 million years to get there.
Can't do it.
And if you find a planet and you find out they have their souls that reincarnate on their planet and they're doing a good job, they're not going to destroy their planet. Would they want us? Would they want us who won't even screw in an energy-saving light bulb? I mean, most of us, I mean, that's what's at stake here. In fact, recently I wrote Edgar Mitchell about this because I wanted to interview him for the film, and he said, well, forget that. Why don't we just fight and save our own planet? Well, I've been a fighter my whole life, you know, planting over a million trees and working on nuclear fusion and blah, 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 all of it. But at this point, even with Schwarzenegger's 25% reduction in greenhouse gases for California, Richard Branson's glorious man, he's one of my greatest heroes, and I look up to Richard Branson, you know, more than almost anybody on the planet.
He's a fighter, isn't he?
I love him. I always looked at him and thought, man, he's a high school dropout, just like Einstein was a college dropout. I always admire people who just say, look, you know, I want to get outside the box. I'm going to do something different, and they make it. And you know, Einstein ultimately gets a PhD, which I think was mostly honorary because he never really went through school. He didn't even do well in college. He was failing in his classes. And then his one mind, that one person's mind affects the entire planet. Well, that's where we're at now. And even with we got less than 1% of the planet using renewable energy and sustainable technologies. I don't think we're going to make it. With the increase in people driving cars, the increase in population, the lack of massive emergency status effort to save the planet, I think it's come to this. And that's why I think CNN announced this. And why is NASA being so aggressive to find a new planet? That's, you know, on CNN. It's September 1st, 2006, for people who want to look it up. It was actually in Popular Science, I think it was. CNN referred to it from that article.
Well, they better have the wormhole, David, because that's the only way they're going to get
there.
Well,
the wormholes don't even work, and that's one of the reasons I ultimately come to singularity, the ultimate theory of how you can move anywhere in the universe in zero time. You know, Richard Branson's building the spaceport in New Mexico. There's a lot of exciting things happening. Al Gore's film, the many episodes on 2020 about, you know, Al Gore, the perspective of how life will end on Earth. But ultimately, I think God wants us to evolve. So if it's an asteroid that beckons us with our end, we have to figure this out. We have to find out how to go interstellar. And with current physics and current propulsion methods, including wormholes, you can't do it. Because wormholes take too much energy, more energy than God to make a wormhole. You need the negative energy of 100 million suns, the total solar output for a whole year, to make a wormhole big enough to transport a quarter through. And the wider the diameter of the snout of the wormhole, the more energy it takes. So you can't do wormholes, at least not the way we're approaching them. So this is like the ultimate conundrum. I mean, it doesn't look like enough people care on this planet to save this place. And maybe when you know, I'm hoping with this new film, this journey from here to Andromeda, when we finally get it, that we're still a million years away from figuring out how to go intergalactic, let alone interstellar. We have to save this place, and it has to be an emergency.
Do you really think, David, we're going to be around for another million years, humankind?
I think, here's what I think, and this is pretty radical. I think, and I can demonstrate why I think this, just like when the dinosaurs went extinct, there are extraterrestrials who know we're about to go extinct, and they're fighting over this planet right now. I don't believe the flying saucers are just getting, you know, accidentally crashing all over the place. There's these UFO crashes all over the place. When you look at Ryan Wood's book, you know, his crash retrieval conference in Vegas coming up, Magic Eyes Only is his book, you see the numbers of saucer crashes. And then when you get into the physics of the crash and you go from, you know, what's his name, from Washington, I don't know why my brain's going blank on him. But anyway, all the way to Roswell, all the way to today, you look at the UFO crashes. Ken Arnold's sighting.
Yes.
For example, Ken Arnold's sighting, here's a classic case. He determines the UFOs are going between Rainier and Mount Adams at 1,800 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the speed of a bullet is about 1,500 miles an hour in World War II. You're talking 1947 here. And then you think, okay, could you shoot down a UFO with one of our munitions at that time? No, you can't. I mean, even going that speed, which is nowhere near their top speed, if the munition is slower than the motion of the craft, you know, you're playing, you know, craps in Vegas. I mean, with your bullets, you're never going to hit the thing. And then you look at the numbers of them that are crashing, and you think, how could you go from one star system to another, and you finally get here? It's like me driving between, which I just did, between Vancouver, Canada, and L.A., 1,500 miles, and I crash when I open the front door. It's kind of that ridiculous.
Let's talk about Singularity when we come back, David, on Coast to Coast AM. What's the overall theme, David, of Singularity, if you would?
Well, Singularity, for me, started actually, you know, after 20-some-odd years of practicing meditation daily with, during the worst year of my life in 1994, I got visited by the most unbelievably, supremely beautiful, shining being of light that I'm not going to say whose name this being is, you know, on the air, but, you know, people will find out in the end of my book if they read it. But this being was so powerful and so bright when this being appeared to me, I fell upon my face. I could barely look upon his most supremely beautiful face. And the whole universe was manifesting out of this, who I call the Supreme Being. And this is where, with this being, I was taught Singularity. And it took me years. In fact, Singularity as a book is really my greatest, I will call it my greatest work and my greatest achievement in my life, which I hope to be, you know, evolving more and more as I get older.
That is huge, David, for an individual to say that about oneself, and so it really must be very important to you.
It's so important to me because what I was being taught in the presence of the Supreme Being, fallen on my face, barely able to look, you know, thousands of times brighter than our sun, and the levels of love and ecstasy and peace and power and beauty and wisdom and graces is even brighter than the light. In fact, it's not even the light that made it so difficult to look, but actually the power and the magnitude of this being. But what started to happen was that the teachings I received in that presence, I was able to verify in, you know, ancient spiritual manuscripts. From different religions, I could see cross-sectioning different religions that the same information was there. In fact, in Buddhism, in Hinduism, and also in mystic Christianity, in the Nag Hammadi Library, I found a wealth of information in the Gospel of Thomas. And then I started applying that to the highest ideals in quantum physics to solve the three great, what I call the three great inertias. And those three great inertias are, the first is the psychological inertia over the knowledge of good and evil, which is the root cause of inner conflict, depression, separating us from the whole, the one, the unenlightened state of mind that leads to war, genocide, and other terrifying corruptions, which we're all facing on this planet right now, and you were talking about that earlier. The second inertia is the inertia of movement. And this one's really interesting because in the Nag Hammadi Library, which is, of course, where Dan Brown's many of his source material comes from, in what's called the trimorphic protonoia, there's the most profound, simple sentence that I just meditate on. I mean, it's like a Zen koan to me. It says that humanity, after the fall, being cast out of the Garden of Eden, we were cast down to the lowest region of all matter in the universe. And it doesn't say geographically the lowest region of the universe. It says the lowest region of all matter. So I often wonder if that code, that actual code that is on matter, which I will demonstrate, prevents us from even seeing other intelligent and even biological beings that may be living on our other nine planets and other planets in our own galaxy. The very fact that NASA can't find other intelligent life in the universe may be because of this code that our matter is actually coded with, which I'll demonstrate. The third inertia is the inertia of disease, death, and, you know, the actual physical...
Like the aging process?
The aging process, disease, death, you know, and how we actually die. I mean, we only live for, you know, 100 years. A good man will live 100 years if he's lucky. And it's kind of like that same time clock. You have 100 years to make your mark, to do something with your life, to experience this thing before the great mystery reveals itself to you again. So for me, those three problems are the greatest problems that human beings face. The fact that we die, the fact that we can't move anywhere, that matter as it is, according to Einstein's law, matter in its current state, I rephrase, cannot move faster than the speed of light. And the speed of light is not fast enough to get anywhere in this universe. I mean, God gave us a really tough problem here. And then, of course, the first one and the great one is war. You know, why do all the religions fight? And I was actually in the presence of this being receiving the teachings that could answer all of these, but it's taken me years. That was in 1994 to actually, you know, in a game of chess, prove it to people. And the only way I could prove it is compare the spiritual models with models in quantum physics. So I started with, and we've, you know, just as a brief overview, we've done the three great inertias in the shows before. And this is very detailed in my book, which is now available. The first inertia I call the psychological inertia, which is over the knowledge of good and evil. When Adam and Eve were in the Garden of Eden, they were in paradise. They originally lived in singularity or oneness. And God warned them, never partake of the knowledge of good and evil, for on the day you do, you will surely die. It doesn't say God will kill them, that God will do anything horrible to them. It says you will die. And that death is actually what I can actually demonstrate. I can actually demonstrate how that happens after we partake of this knowledge of good and evil. In fact, in the Nag Hammadi Library, Trimorphic Protonoia, there are clear statements contradictory to most theological views that the knowledge of good and evil represents chaos. It represents conflict. If you see in your mind right now, if we ingest the knowledge of good and evil, what we're ingesting is a conflict. So going from a state of innocence or enlightenment or oneness, once you ingest conflict is... it cannot survive in a state of love. A state of love is peaceful. It's a state of union where there's no conflict. That is what love is. That is what peace is. So conflict can't exist in peace, so it falls into a lower dimension where it works itself out. Now, when 8 billion people take in the knowledge of good and evil, they identify good and evil egotistically for themselves alone. And when they compare it with their neighbor, of course, they find out we disagree. In fact, rarely do we ever agree 100% on anything. In fact, everybody has a different viewpoint about everything. But some of us generally agree, so we agree to form, you know, corporations, businesses, relationships, and then religions. And even a single religion becomes divided hundreds and hundreds of times and actually documented. Christianity, Buddhism, Hinduism, and, you know, Judaism, all of the great religions are divided in more than 100 times. And in fact, Jesus says in the Gospels that how can Satan's kingdom stand and survive if it is divided? So what this does is, because we absolutely believe that our interpretation of our own religion is correct and the other wrong, we actually get into this trap, this game. We believe it so strongly, we hold it against the other. We even tell our son and our daughter that you can't marry a person who disagrees with our family religion. Mm-hmm. And, you know, meanwhile, the son or the daughter is in love and they want to fall in love with this person and marry them, and the parents, you know, protest. And this is the beginning of the starvation of love in the soul. Because we're not experiencing union, love, we're in this state of conflict, we starve. I actually saw this in the presence of this supreme being, that the duality of good and evil produces a oval or egg-shaped force field around the human soul, and it shields out the omnipresent singularity of the oneness of God. And so we don't experience that connectedness anymore. So ultimately, well, what happens is, of course, we get wars. The ultimate end game for the inner conflict is we take our viewpoint, our fanatical viewpoint of our religion, so seriously, we believe that we're superior to the other, including inside of our own religion. I mean, we know in the Middle East, even most recently, that Saddam Hussein killed Muslims. I mean, they were actually the Shiites and the Sunnis, and I mean, they're all fighting each other. And the same thing has happened historically with Christianity and many other world religions. So we're all guilty of this. We've all taken on that egotistical role of saying that, you know, our view is more superior than the other. So that's the first inertia, which is psychological inertia, and which the end game ultimately is genocide. And that's where we're about to face on this planet today.
And it could be total mass genocide.
It could be total mass genocide. And the idea of the absolute oneness, when the Muslims say that there's only one true God, that one true God is pure oneness. It's not, we egofy, we identify God as the ego. When Jesus said, only by me shall you enter the kingdom of heaven, when he's saying me, it's not the same as when we say me. We say me as an ego. But when Jesus says I, his I is the whole universe. And it's total love for the whole universe and everything in it. So he's saying only by total love for the whole universe, which is the truth of who he is, shall you enter the kingdom of God. But because we personify that as the egos, we take it against the other. Even, you know, in fact, my family's Catholic, and, you know, Catholics are told that by other even fanatical, you know, other Christian groups, that they're going to go to hell. And Catholics believe the same thing about other sects of Christianity. So the madness goes on. Now, what gets really interesting is when we look at this knowledge of good and evil, this duality, and we look at how consciousness may be affecting reality. We look at the atom itself. We all know from the movie What the Bleep Do We Know, from Dr. Emoto's studies on water, that thought can cause water, which is made of very simple hydrogen and oxygen atoms, some of the most simple atoms in the periodic elements scale, that your thoughts can tell the atoms in the water what to do. You know, if you think a loving thought, you know, and you freeze the water, Dr. Emoto's photos show these beautiful crystalline structures. If you think hatred, I hate you thoughts, then the water crystal, the frozen crystals are all chaotic and messed up. Well, if you go even further back to Clive Baxter's work in The Secret Life of Plants in the 1970s, he proved this concept much further back in history, that consciousness was affecting reality, that plants, when hooked up to EEG sensors, could feel our vibrations and our thoughts, and they registered on polygraphs that thought transferred into living organic material. So when we look at the atom, and what we're going to see is the exact same duality, the same pairedness, the same chaos that is in consciousness itself. When we look at the atom, we see that the atom is made of a proton and an electron. A proton is positive charged and the electron is negative charged. And then when we zoom in on the electron, we find out the electron has an anti-electron. So you have electron negative, anti-electron positive. Then when you look at the proton, which is where most of the mass energy in the atom is, it has an antiproton. And then when you go deeper into the proton, you find that the proton is made up of quarks, and quarks are all divided in dual pairs. In fact, everywhere you go into subatomic particles, you see the same duality. So the big question comes, is consciousness telling the atom what to do? Is it keeping the atom in this state? And is that code, the code that the trimorphic protonoia states in the Nag Hammadi Library, that humanity was cast to the lowest region of all matter? And what we find in that code, I mean, I'm just kind of briefly going through an overview.
No, I understand.
That the reason mass, spaceship, pilot cannot go faster than the speed of light is because of inertia. Inertia is the tendency of a body to resist acceleration. And you end up finding out that the root cause of the second inertia, the fact that we can't move faster than the speed of light, is the dual pairedness on matter itself. And in fact, the way to demonstrate this, it's really quite simple. The model that I'll give the audience is that first, look at how humanity has evolved in just travel. First, we took horses and animals and we walked or moved across the landscape in buggies and horses and walking and running. And that method of travel was very, very slow and very cumbersome. And then we invented boats and we started moving through the oceans and lakes. When a boat moves through a body of water, the propeller, which is the propulsion system on the boat, has to spin faster in order for the boat to go faster. But as the boat moves, just like if you stand in a swimming pool and you try to run in the water, you push against the water. That's the tendency of your body to resist acceleration because of the strata, the water that you're moving through. You can't go very fast through water. It takes months to cross the Atlantic. You know, when Columbus discovered America, in 1492, it took him months and months to get across the Atlantic. Well, finally, we find, the birth of air flight, with the Wright brothers in Kitty Hawk in North Carolina. We find that if you fly through air mass, which is a finer strata to move through in propulsion, you can go a lot faster. You can cross the Atlantic in hours instead of months. And that resistance, that inertia, is less because the strata that you're moving through is much more, it's less dense. So, but with the problem with aircraft is the faster you go, the more that wind, that inertia, pushes on the aircraft, making it heavier in relationship to the wind. So you have to apply greater and greater force and propulsion, and eventually the craft starts to become unstable. It starts to heat up, just like the space shuttle does when it enters that dense atmosphere.
And disintegrates.
And it disintegrates, so there's a limitation on how fast you can go, and right now we can go up to almost Mach 10. NASA has this little, X model aircraft. It's unmanned that can go nearly, it's like Mach 9.6. So now, when you go in space, you're going into yet another finer strata. In fact, when we go into space, we think, well, it's a void. In fact, Einstein originally thought it was a void, space was a void. And in fact, he thought, ultimately, people thought if you went into space, you could travel in unlimited speeds. And very quickly, Einstein found out that his law was correct. Even in space, the limit was just under the speed of light for mass. You could not actually attain the speed of light, and that is correct to this day. Because the faster you go, ultimately, you can go a lot faster. The space shuttle does 90-minute orbits, an hour and a half. It makes an orbit around the whole planet, which is much faster.
Can you believe that?
Isn't that incredible? 90 minutes.
It really
is. An hour and a half. Now, when you get frustrated with the problems of inertia in space, you find out that the aircraft or the spacecraft is pushing on the background of space, making it heavier. You can slowly accelerate up to, nearly. If you have it really, powerful nuclear drive systems, ion drive systems, you can get up to 1/10 the speed of light, which is 67 million miles per hour. But then as soon as you want to turn out of the way to avoid an asteroid or any incoming debris, the G-forces on the turn are going to kill you, and they're going to destroy your craft. And ultimately, you're going to have to turn to avoid something, especially when you get out to the asteroid belt, and then which is beyond the solar system, and then you get to the Oort cloud, which is where all the comets are, the ice comets are, which is even a bigger problem than the asteroid belt and the far reaches of the solar system. There's no way you can accelerate towards the speed of light because you're going to hit something. And then the G-forces on the turns at those velocities are going to destroy you. So when you find out that that is a problem, you find out, okay, what is the next strata? You got to get out of space to move faster than the speed of light. It's kind of like, how do you get out of space? Where's this next evolution? And that's where the doorway opens to singularity. When you finally get frustrated with this enemy called inertia, and you look at these different strata, you find out, even with wormholes is almost ridiculous to me. I mean, the idea that people win great physics prizes for these things, instead of sending a spacecraft or a pilot between two distant locations, you want to move the location itself. And you want to fold the fabric of space and time, all of that mass, and bend it so that it's so close to each other, then you create a shortcut wormhole to vector in between those two points.
It sounds good, David.
It sounds good on paper, but it's unattainable. And the fact that we spend so much energy focusing on something that requires the negative energy of 100 million suns for a total year, and we can't even, none of our visible nuclear fuels on this planet can ever produce energy levels, not even a thousandth or a millionth of that, is ludicrous physics. So you have to ultimately wonder how they're doing it. And I remember once when I was in Maui in the year 2000, right up in the sky, I was sitting in the back of this truck, and we were talking, me and this woman were talking about UFOs, and lo and behold, you look up in the sky and you see this boom, boom. Like, it seemed like in the same second there was a ball of light here, and all of a sudden it was 10 miles away in the same second. It was like a pulse. Now, that object did not appear to pass through the intervening space between the two points. Now, if I were a fish under the water and I saw a boat sitting on the top of the water, it would make an indentation into my strata, my sphere, which is water. And yet that little bubble, that boat, would lift up in the air and travel through the air mass. I wouldn't see it traveling up in the sky. Then it would set itself back down on the water. I would see it indent the water in that same way, but I would not see it passing through the water, which is my strata. I think the same thing happened when I saw this UFO jump between those two points. It did not, it got out of what we call space.
So when we come back, tell us how we can get there, David. We'll be back. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you, David Sirita, our guest. David, propulsion then, in the light that you saw, what could have been a craft, how it originated from one point, got to another in the bat of an eye. How does this happen?
Well, see, in order to understand how, firstly, I demonstrate, you know, how inertia, you know, prevents the acceleration of an object in the three major strata that we know, which is water, air, and space. Those are the only three that we know so far. And that you really have to understand, you know, in fact, what I'm going to do different this time than the other times we talked about this is we're going to go to the Big Bang and apply singularity to it. In fact, Stephen Hawking wrote that the actual point of creation lies outside the scope of presently known laws of physics. And a less well-known but very distinguished cosmologist, Professor Alan Guth from MIT, says, quote, the instant of creation remains unexplained. In fact, what singularity is going to do is describe that instant, and you're going to see the birth of these strata. And to understand the birth of them in a brief synopsis, which is massively detailed in my book, you'll understand why we can't move and then where we can move instantaneously anywhere in the universe. In fact, when I think about the idea, and this is a very new thought I'm having right now, is that if consciousness is so powerful that it can tell the atom what to do, you know, to remain in this dual pairedness, and this duality of good and evil and positive, negative charges on the subatomic particles,
right,
is the cause of inertia. How powerful that mind is that ultimately the atom says that I can give birth to life, create stars and planets, but I can also produce a nuclear weapon. That power in the atom is that great that it can produce the end game, which is genocide. What would the atom do if we knew how to tell it a different message?
Well, here's the point, though, David. Let's use this little atom as an example. Mm-hmm. Does it have free will? I don't think so. If the message is do it, it's done.
Well, actually, you know, you get into like Edgar Mitchell's, he calls it the quantum hologram. In fact, I was having this conversation with an amazing conflict strategist and therapist. Her name is Bree Wilson in Vancouver, Canada, and she has these, you know, transcendent guides that she communicates with, and she's going into these quantum physics discussions with them, and she invited, you know, me to talk to her about my work. And one of the things I realized right away is that atoms, this is a simple model of a Niels Bohr's hydrogen atom. When an atom's the electron orbit around the proton shortens its wavelength, the atom radiates off photons. And when it increases its wavelength, which means it's jumping shells, it receives photonic energy. In fact, it's an exchange. And I always knew and believed that that exchange involved intelligent information, that atoms were exchanging information, just like, for example, right now we're talking on the radio all over the world. We're sending information, voices, on light waves, which are called radio waves, which travel at the speed of light all over the world. And we can also send pictures, television, on which those images are carried on light waves, on microwaves, which is where television is broadcasting. So the idea that atoms could exchange intelligent information was, according to Edgar Mitchell, was actually proven very recently by this physicist Walter Schempp. In fact, it's a really fascinating lecture that astronaut Edgar Mitchell discusses, where he proves that the atom is actually conscious. But the problem is, because the atom is dual paired and it's sending information at the speed of light, and the speed of light is only 186,282 miles per second, which comes to 670 million miles an hour, that is not instant. In fact, when we look at light from the Andromeda galaxy, we're seeing it as it was 2.2 million years ago. We're not seeing our universe in real time. Light is giving us an illusion, a false picture. So the only way to really understand why all of this is, why we're trapped in this Maya, this illusion that, and light is playing this game on us that says that you can't move faster than me and I'm your only detection device. You know, relativity relies on the speed of light and light to detect all events in the known universe. We're really kind of trapped. So we have to look at this problem of this instant character that no one can explain. And so it was really Paul Dirac originally who discovered what I'm calling singularity. In fact, it was an accident the way he discovered it. But Dirac actually sees the birth of matter. In fact, I've never heard in the quantum physics world anyone who has actually witnessed the birth of matter and how matter is born from ultra-high frequency gamma waves, which are the highest frequency light waves, which give birth to electron-anti-electron pairs. So you're going from light actually as we know it, as we know it is a singularity. It moves. In fact, Jesus said in the Gospel of Matthew 6:22, if thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be filled with light. Well, it turns out that light has no dual pair inside of it. It spins positive. It propagates along in a wave at the speed of light, but its spin speed is much faster. But light, because it's not traveling instantaneously, is obviously encountering inertia. In fact, when light moves through water, which is one of our three major strata, it slows down, which shows you that water is pushing on it, just like it pushes on our own body as we try to move through water. And that now you have this Einstein-Bose condensate, which takes hydrogen atoms and cools them down to what's called absolute zero, which is, you know, minus 400-something degrees Fahrenheit. I mean, it's colder than space, than the background of space, which is minus 273 degrees. And as light propagates through this Einstein-Bose condensate, it travels at zero velocity. It slows down to zero. And just recently, they found that light is going in negative time. So you're actually finding out that light is trapped in the same duality. So what's pushing upon light? Why can't it move instantly anywhere in the universe? Well, it turns out that this strata, the third strata called space, the background of space, dark matter, is producing negative pressure. And because in a duality, negative and positive are attracted to each other, they put pressure on each other. In the atom itself, the play between the electron and the proton, most physicists think that conflict literally destroys, it cancels out all the energy in the atom. The overall energy and force in the atom is defeated in that conflict.
Do you agree with that?
No. I believe that there's what is called differentials, which gets into a much more complicated thing. Because, for example, this is where I think the missing particle in physics, the graviton, is. The very fact that we're standing on this Earth right now, and you're in St. Louis and I'm in Los Angeles, and there are two forces at play in this planet. This planet is spinning at 1,000 miles an hour at the equator, like a washing machine. We should be thrown and hurled out into space, but we're not. There's another force, centripetal force, which is pulling in, that is competing with that force. And what we experience of gravity is the leftover or differential between those two forces. And if only one of them was at play, just the pulling in force, we would be crushed. We'd be so heavy we couldn't stand up. And if the throwing out force was the only force, we'd be thrown off the planet and none of us would even be here. So the very fact that there's a differential between those two forces, I believe, and I can actually prove this, this is actually proved in my book, Singularity and Actual Wave Models, that there is a differential leftover between electron-antielectron pairs, proton-antiproton pairs, and the differential between the proton-antiproton competes with the differential of the electron-antielectron. And those
You missed me on that one. Tell me that again.
Okay, so the differential between the competition between the electron-antielectron, that competition, just like two people pulling on a rope in opposite directions.
Okay, I understand that.
One of them is slightly greater than the other. And that leftover force moves either forward or backwards, which then meets up with the leftover competition energy between the proton and antiproton, and those two compete with each other. And that's where I think gravity actually is. Because in the quantum world, the atom is smaller. I believe that force is reflecting out into what we call the astrophysical model, which is gravity, as I just demonstrated. It's a competition between two forces. But the competition doesn't end at zero. If the competition between centrifugal, spinning outward, and centripetal, pulling in, was zero, we wouldn't have any weight. In fact, we wouldn't even be standing on the Earth. Everything would just be canceled out to a dead zero. There wouldn't be this pull that's holding us on the Earth. So that's when you get into something called differentials, which is very interesting and detailed in my book. But what happens is, as these forces compete with each other and compete with each other, you get inertia slows things down more and more and more. So what we do is we take singularity, this force that Paul Dirac discovered. He sees the birth of electron-antielectron pairs, and then in bubble chambers, in spark chambers, where they measure the trails that subatomic particles leave in these vapor trails. It's kind of like throwing a rock through fog or a cloud. It leaves a trail, and they photograph the trail. Well, when they strip an electron-antielectron dual pair off of a proton, they see it spins into smaller and smaller diameter or radial distance orbits, which means its wavelength is shortening. Paul Dirac actually calculates the exact moment that the electron, which is the lowest mass particle we know of, it gives up all of its when its wavelength shortens. We know from Niels Bohr's atom that it radiates off its energy. In an Einstein equation, energy and mass are equivalent, so it's giving up its mass-energy equivalent. When it reaches zero, when it gives up all of its mass-energy, you can't see it anymore. And traditional physicists thought, oh my God, they must have crashed into each other and annihilated. And Dirac said, no way. If they did that, there would have been an explosion. Matter and antimatter would have collided, and there was no explosion in the bubble chambers. So they disagreed with him. He said they simply went into a higher frequency state, attained zero mass, which proves that mass can attain zero mass. And because mass and gravity are also in the same relationship as energy and mass, mass and gravity are proportional, you're reducing your mass-gravity effect to zero in your electron, which means you can attain zero mass, which is what I believe these spacecraft are actually doing. When you look at what spacecrafts are made out of in pilots, it's just, at the atomic level, it's just particles and waves.
Well, are they traveling, though, David, or just appearing?
Well, it's only an appearance, and I'll explain to you why. If we take the Big Bang and we're looking for what Alan Guth calls that instant character that no one can explain, and what Dirac says is when you enter this single sea where there's no duality, this sea will not allow this substratum to our whole universe. He defines as absolute negative, which I determine is a mistake as a term, not as a reality, but as a term. This negative, Dirac says, will not allow a dual pair in it. It will spit it out. It won't allow it to exist. But what he discovered was that as soon as you enter this sea, you have to become one with it. You can't be a duality and enter the single sea. And if you become one with it and enter it, you're everywhere in the universe at the same time. In fact, there is no inertia. There's no friction because there's no positive and negative. That means you can be anywhere in the universe in zero time. In fact, you're omnipresent. You're all-knowing. In fact, at that point, you're so baffled, you don't even want to move because you're already everywhere in the universe there is anyway. So the question is, how do you move from here to Andromeda? How do you move from here to another star system? And how is that instantly moved? They're not actually moving through space, and I'll show you when we see the birth of the three strata.
All right.
What happens is that at the instant of creation, you have all of your values. Time has a value of zero because if there's no inertia and you can be anywhere in zero time. Your time value is zero in this infinitely, you know, bigger than the universe we know of, strata. And then your space, which is your X, Y, Z, which is height, width, and length, depth, those X, Y, Z coordinates have values of absolute zero because space is an illusion caused by the idea that you have to move through it in what a factor of time. Time is Einstein's fourth dimension. Now, in a singularity, as soon as a duality exists, just like we're going back to the Garden of Eden, as soon as you go from a state of love, a state of union where there's no conflict, and you introduce conflict, duality, it spits it out. It falls to a lower level because a conflict can't survive in love. So that, imagine that infinitum of energy in the singularity, which is not really energy as we know it today. And as soon as the first dual pair is formed, what happens is this. You have two, a positive and negative wave with an enormous, enormous clash. And as those two waves crash into each other, the temperature is so massive, which according to traditional theory today, at the moment of the Big Bang, and this is the new instant character that nobody knows where it is, the temperature was I think it was 100 billion degrees. I think that's So you look at the temperature of the universe at the moment of the Big Bang, 100,000 seconds after the Big Bang, you get a temperature of 100 degrees, 100 billion Kelvin, and a density a billion times greater than water. So as soon as you have duality, you have a strata, you have a fabric being formed, and time value, because now you have inertia. As soon as you have friction, your inertia is your first force is duality. Your second force is inertia, which is resistance. And because there's resistance to move, your time value goes from zero and it starts increasing. And as it increases, the universe more and more waves after the first two waves crash together. They create shock waves and those waves crash into each other, which produces more and more resistance, which means time value is now increasing. So the universe gives the illusion that it's expanding over a period of time. So what singularity says is that the universe was pre-existently infinite. It never was not infinite. In fact, it was already pre-expansive. And this explains, according to Dirac, why the cosmic microwave background radiation is evenly distributed rather than a gradient temperature from hot to cold, which would, over a period of time, the background of space should be cooling down, but as the universe expands, that cooling curve should go from hot to cold, and it doesn't. The background temperature is even. So singularity answers that. So what happens is as more and more dual waves are crashing into each other, the soup of the background of space is getting thicker, and that's the stuff you have to move through when you want to move from one point to another. But when you move through a dual paired billions and trillions of atoms, they're going to push on you and slow you down.
How do you then make this happen?
How you make it happen is it's about transformation. It's about, ultimately, I believe that UFOs were building wave generators, the most advanced civilizations, which are ultimately the highest spiritually evolved beings, that transform their mass into singularity, and they enter the singularity field. And they're all knowing. They're everywhere in the universe. In fact, at this point, you've proven the existence of God, the great, what Jesus constantly refers to in the Gospel of Thomas, which we went over in the last show, that if you make the two one and you tell the mountain to move, it will move. He's telling you how you can move a whole mountain is by, you know, telling the atoms to become single. You know, when you make the two one. And in fact, Jesus says in the Gospel of Thomas, on the day that you were one, you were in the light, and then when you became two, what will you do? He's actually telling you the process of singularity, going from singularity to duality. He knows that as soon as you become a dual-paired being, you're going to experience death, because the cells in your body, in the third inertia, are also trapped in that same duality. In fact, when you look at the double helix of DNA, you see the ultimate fabric, the dual-paired fabric of also of our DNA, which causes the cells in our body to be fighting each other.
You know, David, I feel like I'm talking to the modern-day Carl Jung. I mean, really, I have that approach. Has anybody ever tied you in with him?
Well, actually, yeah, my father, who got his PhD in Berkeley in the 60s, was a big, you know, Jungian, you know, student. And to me, you know, this is, like I said, this is the greatest work that I will ever contribute to. I'm relying on all the great physicists of our time, but this supremely enlightened being who was standing before me was teaching me this, and I had to put it in a form to answer the three great inertia.
I know it's a tough topic for people to grasp, but you're doing a good job, I think, explaining it.
So now when you see in the Big Bang how the universe developed the three strata and you find your way back to singularity, ultimately, if you can wave transform the atoms in your spaceship and your pilot to singularity and enter it, you can go anywhere in the universe in zero time. In fact, light as we know it is part of the illusion. Light was created after inertia. You have inertia, friction, heat, and then light is born, which illuminates the duality.
So all right, stay with us. Let's take phone calls when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Open the lines. How many years do you think, David, these extraterrestrials might be ahead of us if they have tapped into your thoughts and theories on singularity? 100 years, thousands of years, millions of years? At what point did they realize how to do this?
I think they reached the same point we did. They saw their demise, and in fact, I believe when in the trimorphic prosopopoeia, when God says that we were cast to the lowest region of all matter, that code on matter is duality, and that is what prevents us. We have to actually end internal conflict, each one of us individual, to conquer war. This way the universe protects itself from different star systems. I mean, you have to become a peaceful, loving human being to go interstellar, to have that realization, because you have to cancel out inertia, and the only way you can do that is to attain singularity as a space vehicle and as a pilot. And once you attain that, then it's like the universe says, okay, now you're free to go around because I know you're not going to go around blowing everybody up. And I think that's one of the reasons there are many UFO cases where, like in the Battle of 42 in L.A., we fired at these UFOs all night and they never fired a single shot back at us because they're nonviolent. Although, of course, I agree there are UFOs or aliens that are violent and are very intrusive, but I don't think those ones can travel through the singularity. I think they're using inferior technology. So when you reach this critical mass, it's kind of like consciousness has to accelerate. You have to figure out how to survive. It's like if you throw a cat, you know, into the midair, it's going to land on all fours. When, you know, the first time I went skydiving, I thought, oh my God, how does a human being float through the air? And within seconds, you're doing it. And next thing you know, I've done high altitude skydives. I've jumped at nighttime, which seems the most insane thing in the world, but you actually adapt. We're at that point right now. We're about to destroy the planet. Al Gore's proved it to us, if you believe it. He's convinced me that we don't have much time left. I mean, for example, some people don't think, well, the planet heated up a couple of degrees, 2 or 3 degrees. What happens to the human body when we're at 98.6 and you increase it 3 degrees?
You don't feel well at all.
You're sick, right? And your whole body goes out of whack. So the planet's the same way. It's a very sensitive organism.
It's alive.
So if it's 3 degrees too hot, it's got a fever. And that's what's going on. And I think because we're so close to our demise, or at least a big chunk of us are going to die off, we have to figure this out in an emergency. And that's kind of, you know, what I'm hoping all of this is going to do. And for those of us who want to continue the human experience and we want to share our music, our art, and I mean, just think if all of this art and all of this music alone and the cuisine and how food has evolved, we never get to tell another civilization what it's like to have a salad or, you know, whatever your favorite dish is or who your favorite musician is. I really believe other civilizations in Andromeda or in our galaxy would love to hear, you know, Otis Redding, Lena Horne, to you, the concert I saw at the Hollywood Bowl last weekend. I mean, there's so much beauty in humanity, and it's all going to go to waste if we don't get to share it, if we don't figure out how to go interstellar, and if we don't stop destroying our planet. This is an emergency to me. So how advanced in years are they? If you consider the acceleration of consciousness, they might only be 1,000 years ahead of us, some of them.
All right, to the phones we go. You ready, David?
Mm-hmm.
West of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
George, how are you guys doing tonight?
We are great, thanks.
Great. I think your guest is on to something. I mean, I like, you know, how he links, I guess, religion and, you know, science, you know, so hardcore science to put these theories together and stuff. I think it's just fascinating. But my question was, have you guys either had any experience with, you know, I guess, energized water that has, like, a negative spin? Because I know your guest was talking about, you know, how water has a memory. And I know you've had guests on, you know, previously, you know, saying that water does indeed have a memory. And, you know,
Dr. Emoto.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, and how you could put it, and how you could put a negative spin of that. And I wonder if you guys have tried it, and does it have any effects on the body, you know, that you guys know of?
No, well, I have not. What about you, David?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, just from practicing meditation, you know, for many, many years, when you end the internal conflict in your body and you become peaceful, you age less, you feel better. That's just, those are some of the, you know, early benefits. Then you start to have really profound, powerful spiritual experiences that most people would never believe. I mean, I could start telling stories of beings that I've met and experiences I've had, and people just wouldn't believe it, that's possible for a human being to have those experiences. But they become more and more frequent as you practice meditation more and more and more. And that's what this is all about. So why water? I mean, water, hydrogen atoms are the most simple, and oxygen atoms, simple structures of atoms, and they're the most likely to experience the effects that human consciousness, the human brain, is a wave generator. When waves cross each other's path, water is just particles and waves. They exchange information. We know from Walter Shemp and, you know, Edgar Mitchell's work in the quantum hologram that atoms are intelligent. They actually exchange information, just like we're talking on the radio right now. So, yes, you know, water is consciousness. It has a memory. And in fact, one of the problems I asked myself in the Big Bang was, there's this great universal Zen koan. If a tree falls in the forest and there's nobody there to see it fall, did it fall? At the time of the Big Bang, the first 100,000 seconds, and the temperature is 100 billion degrees Kelvin, does anybody exist? Where is consciousness? There's no organic life forms. So if no one saw the Big Bang, did it even happen? And that's when you get into looking for consciousness, that, in fact, the consciousness is telling the atoms to be dual-paired. In fact, consciousness may be so powerful, I'm becoming interested in producing consciousness amplifiers to see more profound effects they'll have on water and atomic structures.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate that. First-time caller line, you're on with David Sirita on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Jack Chapman, Anderson, South Carolina. How you doing,
hello,
George?
Hello, Jack.
David?
Thank you, sir. Good.
I really enjoyed the program. I'm a long-time listener, but this is my first call. So I've got a couple of things. I noted a couple of factual errors, I think, in David's discussion, and if not, maybe he could correct me on them.
Sure.
One thing that he stated was that when the space shuttle was in orbit, and, you know, with space debris and small items of junk and stuff like that, that they couldn't pass the shuttle. The speed without some internal power source. And I disagree with that. That would depend only on the original speed of the item, would it not?
Well, think about it. If space debris fell off of an earlier mission, which is what they're proposing, not the current mission, it's not part of the current payload, you're talking about several missions ago, its velocity would decay slower and slower and slower because it has no internal energy. So how would it go faster than the space shuttle, which is using propulsion to maintain 18,000 miles an hour around the Earth? And the space shuttle is traveling, again, at 300 miles above the Earth, and the distance between the shuttle and the debris would be very far. And the definition of debris, you know, we don't dump the trash out on the space shuttle. We don't dump water unless it's an emergency. So what is it?
Okay, I follow you. I probably misunderstood you. One other quick question.
Sure.
I wonder if you could tie in the, I guess it was Einstein that talked about the spooky action at a distance, where if you have a negative particle and a positive particle so far apart that they instantly react to each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was
into your discussion, please.
Yeah, that was, and Edgar Mitchell solves that problem in the quantum hologram. When you see how atoms are exchanging actual information, action at a distance appears instantaneous, but really it's because it's light emission, photon emissions coming off of the atoms, and each atom is, you know, most of them are right next to each other. The exchange between the atoms appears instant, but it's really traveling at the speed of light due to, you know, the dual pairedness of an, and inertia. So the only way that consciousness can move instantaneously, truly instantaneously between, you know, intergalactic events would be through singularity. But action at a distance is explained with this this new work that Walter Shemp has proven, that it's the when the atom is emitting photons and receiving them, there is it receiving and exchanging intelligent information. So that explains the action at a distance.
Okay, good. Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm going to have to make a little deeper into it. Thank you very much.
Singularity, where do you get it, by the way, David?
Singularity you get at www.lulu, which is lulu.com, and then a / David Sereda, and Sereda is Sereda, and all those links are up on your website right now at Coast to Coast AM.
Lulu?
Lulu, yeah, they're an online publisher.
They
send you a printed book, or you can download it for a way less cost. I mean, you can actually download it as a PDF and view it on your computer screen.
All right, great. Wildcard Line, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello, David. Hello, Nori.
Yes, sir.
Hello. Yes, hi, David. I guess you're, as far as I'm concerned, you're one of the top guys in ufology.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I've been studying this for, 20-plus years. I've worked in a defense with some projects, and I come to learn a lot of about the UFO phenomena as well. You're familiar. I could tell you a couple things about how the propulsion system operates and how they really move about. Number one, their craft basically they convert the craft from matter to light. As you, when you see them oscillating or pulsing,
right.
They're taking the craft and they're basically doing something with matter. I can't really get on the
deep. Yeah, no, I understand. Yeah, they're reducing the mass gravity effect by wave transformation, which is what it looks like they're turning into light. And they become as light as photons, in fact, eventually even lighter. So
exactly, yeah. They basically transform matter into light force energy so that therefore there's no gravitational effect.
Yeah, there's no gravity where there's no mass. There's no mass, there's no mass gravity effect, there's no gravity. And there's
correct.
No g-forces on turn, so yeah.
Exactly correct. And how they basically, the propulsion system, how they operate is actually they do not transverse through our skies in a conventional way. They're mostly they're using a frequency, which is a pulse frequency. They're
mm-hmm.
not flying through there, they're pulsing.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do see them like that, majority of the craft you see will see that they'll be illuminated because they have transferred from the matter to the antimatter to energy of force.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that's basically just a basic, simple part. I was going to give you some information about the UFO phenomenon, the scientific part of the, I don't know if you're familiar about the abductees and people who have been contacted and abducted for, you know, different type of experiments done on them.
Mm-hmm.
But,
I'm very familiar, lot of abduction stuff. I'm not an abduction researcher. I leave that to people in that field. But what interests me in abduction or contact is like when, for example, major physicists, the way they get sudden revelations. There are many stories of great scientists and mathematicians who later explain, you know, contact, like, for example, John Nash. He claimed that he was in contact with extraterrestrials, and I think that's one of the way they non-intrusively communicate with us so that we evolve.
Exactly,
and for me, it was
yeah.
the same thing.
Yeah, throughout human history, we've the contactees are and have been seeded with technological information to progress us forward.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of scientists, a lot of people, inventors and stuff, even people in music industry and people see on television have been influenced by these individuals throughout history and stuff.
So, yeah, music is an incredible area in itself. You know?
Okay, great. Hey, thanks for your call. Appreciate you being on Coast to Coast. East of the Rockies, you're on with David Sereda. Hi there.
Hello?
Hi.
Oh, hi. I just heard Rockies. I wasn't sure if it was me. East of the Rockies. How you doing?
Good, sir.
David, you're one of the most brilliant people I've ever heard in my life.
Thank you, sir.
I came up with an idea about 10, 15 years ago. I call it GAS. It's a gyroscopic electromagnetic synchronized source where you use the magnetic poles of the Earth to bounce from one end of the Earth to the other. It's probably kind of kindergarten for you after hearing about singularity and everything. But I think some of these crashes that have happened, it's like walking through quicksand. These spaceships are coming around, and all of a sudden they run into an area that's highly electromagnetic, and it screws up their equipment.
Mm-hmm. Now that makes sense. I mean, electromagnetic waves can affect a craft that's in a low mass gravity effect state because they're, you know, if your craft is basically, as the previous caller, as light as a photon, then a low amplitude wave could cause some distortion. But I think they're much more prepared than that. I mean, I think, you know, I could give a good argument that it's possible that they're fighting with each other over who gets this planet next after we're done with it. But, you know, maybe they are crashing. I mean, I'm not saying I know the answer. This is a game of chess here.
I was, I don't mean to interrupt you. I was sitting in a doctor's office a few years back and reading a science magazine, waiting. And this one guy, I believe it was from Berkeley, mentioned that a pure gyroscope will levitate. And then later on in the magazine, there was some guy actually from somewhere around Boston who was talking about something else. And I thought these two guys should get together. And that's what gave me the idea about the electromagnetic synchronized source, because once you've got the gyroscope moving around, that can charge generators, which would charge batteries, and then you've got perpetual motion, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's only one thing that escapes gravity on this planet that escapes it. It's still affected by it, and that's light. Light, you know, bounces off the Earth and goes out into space. It's affected and it's pulled by gravity, but it's not held down by it, and that's because of the spin state that photons are in. They're initially in a non-dual spin state. They spin positive, and they propagate along at the speed of light. So they don't have a dual pair inside of them. They encounter their dual pair as they move through the strata of the fabric of space, which produces its opposite, which is negative pressure. So, but that explains, yeah, if you spin a field strong enough, you can counteract gravity.
Looking at some of my fast blast messages, David, and overwhelming. These listeners and folks just love what you're saying. They're grasping it. And they're pushing you up the charts.
I'm trying to keep singularity simple, even though in my book, you know, there's a simple way to get through it, and then you can reread it and learn more and more about it. But ultimately, I mean, of any subject I've ever spoken of on your show, this is where the next day the emails come in by the hundreds and the thousands, and I can't even get to all of them.
Wildcard line, you're on with David. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. This is Latham Tyler. I wanted to ask David, the possibility, would it exist that as a denser mass, like a star, collapses into a black hole and it collapses in towards that point of singularity, could it be possible that it rebounds back into a very ultra-hyper energetic state where it appears like it's a solid black round mass, but it's actually just got a valence skin around it, much like a bubble does, and everything that exists within is a universe, and that which exists without is a separate universe. Could I just lay that out there and let him?
Well, if you think about, like, go to Paul Dirac's model of just the birth of the first dual pair coming from the singularity of super high frequency gamma waves, and then you go to duality, and you see the birth of mass. You go from zero mass to mass. And if you scale that up to the Big Bang, I mean, the first, you have this infinitum of singularity, which you can call God or the God force. And as soon as a dual pair forms, it spits it out and with an infinite amount of energy on a much larger scale. It produces a universe, a whole dual pair universe. So it's possible that there are multiple universes. Now, black holes, which is where singularity got its original term, is really the same thing. In a black hole, when both sides of the dual pair of the vortex of the black hole touch, they reach singularity, which is really the highest frequency wavelength. When the wavelength in the black hole gets smaller and smaller and smaller, its frequency gets higher and higher and higher, and ultimately you go to super gammas, and eventually you reach singularity, you know, exactly where Dirac found it. So I think in Dirac's model, when he sees the electron anti-electron pair spin into higher and higher frequency orbits, they eventually give up all of their mass energy and attain zero mass, which would mean black holes are not mass increasing. Mass gravity is reducing towards zero, and that's why they accelerate at the core of the black hole.
All right, David, stay with us. Back with you with final phone calls. What a fast night on Coast to Coast AM. David, this entity that you reveal in the back portion of the book is Singularity.
Mm-hmm.
How did it come to you? Did you will it to be?
No,
or did it happen?
I never even really realized that there was a being so supremely enlightened. I just practiced my Buddhist meditation every day. My family was Catholic, you know, and I did yoga. My father, Dr. Lynn Sarita from Berkeley, introduced me to meditation at such a young age, and I started to really benefit from it and have profound experiences. But, you know, upon that experience and, you know, when I met this thing, I've now had three meetings with this same, you know, personality, divine personality. And that is my teacher. That is where I'm learning all this singularity stuff that I'm sharing with everybody, that I'm synthesizing with all the great work of our great physicists. And it was such, when it happened, I was in the worst time of my life. I had an environmental eco-venture capital company go bankrupt. I had contracts with Nobel Prize winning signatures on technologies. I could not raise a single dime with the richest people on the planet, whose names, you know, I won't name. They didn't want to do anything in the 1990s about sustainable technologies. And when I went broke, I planted trees, as I always did that year, to get some extra income.
Mm-hmm.
And I was back taxed, fined by the government, and they wiped out my whole bank account, and I was exhausted, carrying 45 pounds of trees around my waist all day in the rain and the snow. And I pitched a tent on my father's ranch in Topanga in 94. And during the rainstorms of 94 in October, they were worse than ever. My tent was flooded. I mean, you couldn't get any worse.
I mean, can you believe that? Your world is collapsing around you, and your tent floods.
And your tent floods.
The last bastion of security.
I just took the covers off me. I could have gone inside, but I was, you know, 3 inches of water, getting hypothermia. And I just said, God, take me. And when I said God, I had no idea who I was about to meet. And, oh, my God, I mean, ever since that happened, I have now seen, and I swear this is the truth, hundreds of ghosts. And I saw my aunt after she died, my grandmother, with perfect clarity, full three-dimensional beings that are invisible to the human eye. I see them. I don't see them as frequently now as I did when I was having these meetings. But I just saw one the other night, for example. It's really the most amazing thing to see someone who has passed away that you know, glowing with light right in front of you and sticking my hand right through them. And, you know, invisible dimensions. I mean, for me, it was the fun part was proving that they exist. And now with the advent of these digital cameras, you know, you on your site, you're getting people sending in photos of UFOs that show up that they didn't see when they took the photo.
That's right.
And ghosts. And so now we're starting to see that, yeah, we only see from red to violet in these invisible spectra. That's part of the code. I think what the trimorphic Portnoy says, that we were cast to the lowest region of all matter, I think the code on the atom, the dual code, is preventing us from seeing other extraterrestrial life, possibly on our own planets and our own solar system. They may be there, but that code has thrown us into this spectra that puts us alone, you know, alone in the universe. There may be beings on Jupiter and Saturn that are very, you know, very, very advanced beings, but they're living in a dimension that we can't see right now. We can't experience it.
To final calls we go. Wildcard Line, welcome to the program. You're on with us. Hello there.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Hi, my name is Daniel Carpenter. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
You too. Yeah, go ahead.
I just want to say I'm actually being taught. I found a teacher recently.
Mm-hmm.
He has been taught by many famous yogi masters, like Paramahansa Yogananda and them. And I just want to say what your guest here is talking about is the truth. And sorry, I'm a little out of it right now. I can't believe I'm on. But yes, through meditation, which I'm doing right now, the singularity he's talking about is also, you know, Christ consciousness, the cosmic consciousness, and in India, the Bhagavad Gita is known as the Krishna consciousness. Mm-hmm. This is what he's kind of portraying, kind of, and through the meditation, which is meditation, it brings you closer to God. You can achieve this cosmic consciousness, and that's what I'm meditating for right now. Once I reach that level, my yogi master, my teacher, will kind of helped me to experience that.
Yeah, the more people on the planet that do this work on their own self, they end the internal conflict and become peaceful and nonviolent, the war is over. Because once the war is over inside of you, you know, you're feeling all this love for all beings. The real one true God is not a God of war. That's the insanity of duality. And so these wars will all end, and all this wasted money and technology on machines of war will be gone. But if we don't graduate, you know, we don't accelerate, you know, it looks like, at least on the environmental front, we won't even have this battleground to act out our wars and our vengeance against each other anymore. This whole thing is over. We have to figure this out. And to me, it's an emergency.
Are you positive and upbeat about the future? Yes, absolutely.
I love that. I say this in spite of hoping that we will make it. So I'm not as pessimistic as I sound. I'm sounding pessimistic only because, yes, we're less than 1% renewable energy today, but there's a lot of great things happening, like Schwarzenegger and Richard Branson. These are great steps. But I still don't know, if you look mathematically at the population increases, if we will make it. I sure hope we do, because if I could travel from here to Andromeda, at best hopes, I would find another planet just as beautiful as this and no more beautiful. And really, if that's all I'm going to find in Andromeda, then why go there? Why not come back to Earth?
And I believe, David, it's not just going to be environmentally.
Yeah.
We say, but the whole package that's bombarding us right now, I do believe that there is a light at the end of the tunnel.
And your show is the greatest blessing right now to me on this planet, just to be able to talk about this. So you can get a wave going out there, and I'm so grateful to Coast AM to be able to, and all of the guests on your shows who are contributing to this movement. It's fantastic. Just to have this, you know, to have you and Art and the whole thing, it's just been a great blessing.
First time caller line, you're on with David Sirita on Coast to Coast. Welcome to the program. Hi there.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, sir. Thank you.
Good. I was my first time caller. I've been listening to the show since 1995. The reason why I started listening to this show is me and my friend seen a flying saucer come out of Erie one night. It was so close to the car, splashed water on the car. But it came out like a ball of light. And I was trying to figure out why did it come out as a ball of light, and the light went all out, then it was a flying saucer sitting there. I mean, was that like to protect the hull?
No. See, if you follow what we've been saying, that the mass, the steel, when you wave transform it, it turns into light. It essentially reduces its weight, its whole mass gravity effect down to zero, and it turns into light. And when it's in that state, it can accelerate, and the pilot and the craft do not experience G-forces when they turn. For example, if you're doing the speed of light and your mass gravity is at zero and you need to turn right to avoid something, you're not going to experience any G-forces because you don't weigh anything. You're as light as a photon.
But does it cause the sonic boom?
What's that?
It was a big explosion in the flash.
Well, when you convert your light back into mass and you're still moving very quickly, you'll produce a sonic boom as you're coming in. Because you want to become physical again to experience Earth. You know, you're not going to be vibrating in those higher dimensions anymore.
Okay, but it went over to the power plant. The ship went over to the power plant and just sat over the power plant.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to visit with charging anything? Or?
Oh, I doubt it was recharging. They're not using the kind of energy. I mean, it may be a less evolved. Like I said, not all craft are using the singularity. Those are the super most advanced civilizations in the universe, but there are probably some other ones. I doubt they're recharging. They may just be checking it out.
Yeah, that scared us half to death, man.
Wow, that's cool. That's a good story.
Yeah, it happened all of a sudden. Just pow, and it was then. When I panicked, my friend, he freaked out. I've never seen a human so terrified in all my life.
Wow, that's incredible. Well, there's, there's more and more sightings going on over the planet. I mean, actually, I forgot to mention, George, right on the 20th of September, after the reports of the cylindrical UFOs or debris on the space shuttle, in Puerto Rico, there's a report of a cylinder-shaped UFO as big as a 747 and after 3 minutes, it just blinked out. It went invisible. And so you see the same shape as the objects that were seen on the space shuttle now appearing, you know, on the Earth and Earth space environment, but also with the ability to transform and go invisible.
Okay, great. Appreciate that. Next up, let's go to our wildcard line. You're on the air with us. Go ahead, sir.
Hi, George. This is Steve in Los Angeles.
Steve, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'd like to wish David a happy birthday and like to let him know when he was born, I was studying astronomy at UCLA with George Abel.
Oh, wow.
Well, anyway, I've got an interesting thing for you to hear. I studied the sky for many, many nights and just watching it. And one night, right from Jupiter, three lights back-to-back arced right over to the moon. Within 2 seconds, they were there.
Oh, my. You saw it in your telescope?
No, with my naked eye.
Wow.
Oh, no, it just blew me away. It
must have been pretty big objects to see it like that, huh?
Well, I don't know, but they were
brilliant. In reality. I mean,
well, I don't know what. They were very brilliant. You know, they were as bright as Jupiter.
You see, that's kind of what I was talking about. There may be intelligentsia on Jupiter that vibrates in a frequency that we don't see. Just like, imagine if you took digital cameras to Jupiter, George, and these invisible phenomena showed up in that atmosphere. Who knows? I mean, they may not be organic beings like us, but there may be beings that have the ability to transform who live on other planets in our own solar system.
Well, I just want to say that, David, just so you know that things can travel that fast, and I saw it.
Oh, yeah, I believe it. I've seen it myself. That, you know, and I love hearing stories like this. You know, I hear stories so often of a luminous craft. I heard this at the Barry UFO Expo, and it hovered over them and suddenly accelerated out into space at tremendous speed. And I just think if you have mass, the G-forces would kill you on that acceleration. You have to be at zero, very light, almost as light as a photon to go that fast, that quickly, and not experience G-forces. So all over and over and over you hear these same stories. Another woman at the Bay Area told me she was looking out the window of her airplane in the 60s, and she saw this diamond-shaped UFO just shooting down to the ground, stopping on a diamond, accelerating back up, and then down again, and then up again. And, you know, again, you can't do that with conventional propulsion systems. And the G-forces would kill you on that kind of movement if you weren't transformed.
East of the Rockies, we find you with David Cerita on Coast to Coast. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm actually a first-time caller, but this is the only number that I could program
on
my phone.
Okay, sir, that's all right.
I had a question about the overall concept of dualism.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask him. Actually, this is the first time I'm listening to the program and everything, driving home from work.
Oh, first-time listener.
Yes. If there is a realm called singularity where everything is positive,
mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask him to, and maybe I missed it, go over again where the introduction of dualism would even come into play. Because as you were talking about good and evil and dualism, as I think about good and evil, that to me really doesn't represent dualism, because good by itself can stand and exist. Because just thinking about people, we do things just for the sake of it being the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when we think of what is evil, evil in itself does not stand on its own. People don't do anything just for the sake of it being evil, the way we do things because we ought to, because it's good. But what we call evil is actually still the pursuit of something good, but in a very, what we would call a negative way. But overall outcome, the pursuit of the person who's, you know, perpetuating the act, you know, they're still looking for something good. So to me, that looks like good is still by itself, and evil, we're saying it's this opposite, but it really isn't. It's still the pursuit of something good. So,
well, evil, it depends on the perspective. That's the problem, is people disagree inside of a single religion what is absolutely good and what is evil. And evil is just live spelled backwards, which means life-taking force. Conflict is what causes us to take life. So the conflict over who's right about good and evil or who's right about their religion causes people to go to war in the same religion and kill each other. That's that. When there's no conflict, there's no violence. When there's no more good and evil, there's no violence. Jesus said in the Gospel of Philip, in this world there is good and evil. it's good things are not good, and it's evil things not evil. And he's not saying that, you know, he's not arguing with you. He's saying if you end the conflict, there's no more war. There's no more violence. There's no more life taking force, which is what evil is live spelt backwards. So you have to look at, in fact, that's why I said the original interpretations of theologians was that it's a good thing that we can distinguish between good and evil. But if you look back in the Nag Hammadi Library, the early Christian writings, and even in the current Bible, you'll see that God clearly warned in Genesis that you shall, if you ever take of the knowledge of good and evil, you will die. Because good and evil can never be solved. It's a riddle. It's a poison and that gets into everybody's mind. And everybody thinks they got it right and the other guy's got it wrong. And that's the problem. It's a poison. If there's no good and evil, there's no conflict in you. If there's no conflict in you, you're incapable of producing a violent act because you're peaceful.
I am convinced that this universe, it has the good, the evil, the positive, the negative in almost every area, David.
Oh, yeah. It does. And that's, you see, it's a code. But when you go beyond good and evil, there's something that is truly ineffable. If we take our greatest goodness that human beings experience, and it is good, healthiness, wholesomeness, even with the best health foods in the world, you still die. Some people I know who are on the best diets in the world get cancer and they die.
Yes.
You can't escape that life-taking force called death. Jesus said, of all men born of a woman, there's no one better in goodness than John the Baptist, but the least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he. That's because when you go beyond good and evil, you get to the ineffable, that which is inconceivable. Good is still a concept. It's a concept. It's conceivable. You can conceive of your good. In fact, if I gave every person on the planet the energy and the money to build any life they wanted for themselves, they would eventually get bored. That's what happens to Buddha. Buddha lives in a palace. He marries Yasodhara, this most beautiful Indian woman. He has everything he could possibly imagine, but he still eventually gets bored, and he realizes there has to be something beyond this goodness.
So true. So true, David.
Yeah.
Be careful what you wish for. We've seen this happen time and time again with people with, you know, again, more money than they know what to do with. And therefore, that becomes very dangerous because they start to dabble in
things. You have that same realization that Buddha did, that you can have anything you want, but you still get bored because your soul knows there's something beyond good and there's something beyond the ultimate egotistical creation. There's something way beyond that. And that's
David, my friend. Thanks for being on the program, David.
Thank you, George.
David Sirita. Go to his website. It's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. So here we go for Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Gina Salvetti, Antonio Giordano, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.